The next hour, we are joined by the man to my broadcast left and your broadcast right. He's a veteran of more than 1,600 National Hockey League games as an official. Fans here in Calgary would be very, very familiar with the 88 worn by this man as a linesman. Mike Sivek joins us in the Hot Stove Lounge until 4 o'clock. Appreciate this, Mike. How are you?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm just glad I could help out in any way I can.
Yeah, you're helping us out. The off-season, it's kind of like... Yeah, you had a short season, and now you're back to what you were doing from October to January.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to believe. I was actually back engineering my training program, and it's already 12 weeks of training camp.
Season's not over yet.
Yeah, season's not over, and we're counting training camp already.
Holy cow! So what is a summer for a tenured NHL linesman like?
Well, for me, it's just, I've been, since the season's finished for me, I've been dance dad and school dad and work around the house dad and just kind of making sure that I'm all healthy before I start my training regime again, which finally in the, since 4 years ago when I got a fracture in my foot and it just hasn't come around, and then I had a new fracture and it's really affected my workouts, but now I'm, touch wood, I'm healthy and ready to go and back in the gym. So we'll see what transpires over the next 12 weeks.
The training regimen, is it similar to what a player would do? You take some downtime and then you get right back into the swing of things?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the grind of the season, you really have to give your body a chance to just rest and, all the aches and pains and injuries, give them a chance to heal up before you start working out. Because if you don't, you're just... working out on an injured body and you're just going to get more injured. And that's what happened to me in the last four summers is I was training and I was training on injuries and they just don't get any better. You go to camp and you get through training camp and then you're like, okay, we'll start the season and I'll have a chance to heal while I'm working, which is kind of weird, but it doesn't happen. And then you get hurt and then you get, you start getting in the way because you can't get out of the way. Guys start running into you, and then the first injury that you had, it gets compounded because now somebody hits you from the side, and now your knee's sore, and it goes on top because you couldn't move because your foot's sore, and it just becomes a nightmare. So you just let your body heal and then get into the gym and do the things you need to do to pass your tests at training camp.
NHL linesman Mike Sivek is with us here in the Hot Stove Lounge. And Robbie, he talks about the grind of the season.
Yeah.
I think it'd be a perfect time to throw out your trivia question because it is a grind for a linesman.
We were just kind of looking at, because if you go to NHLofficials.com, you guys have your own website. I don't know if a lot of people know this. It's actually kind of a cool site.
Yeah, we just revamped it this past season. So I think finally our new web provider has everything up. I haven't been on it lately. I'm in charge of our alumni association, so I got to make sure that all their alumni are on there, and it's a really neat site that they've really enhanced it from what we originally started with.
Yeah, and it's kind of what I like about having you on here is we can talk about a few things that maybe people don't know, and we often talk about the teams and what they do to give back to the community. But Zebra Cares, tell me a little bit about that and what you guys do.
Well, that kind of morphed off of what the teams do with their players going to visit sick kids in hospitals and things like that, and. I believe it was in Toronto where somebody from the Leafs organization, and that was when Brian Burke was in charge, came down and asked if our guys would be up to having a few of the kids that were at the game come down into our room and just meet the guys, see what we do before a game, and then come down after the game and see what we do after. And we were like, yeah, sure, it'd be great to have the kids in, and they had a great time. And then, another team heard what Toronto had done, so it kind of morphed as more teams heard what we were doing, more teams wanted to get involved with it, and then we started our own Zebra Cares thing, kind of like the umpires in Major League Baseball have done, and we've kind of piggybacked some of their stuff, so it's been really good. I've been involved in about five of them. One of them was in Philadelphia, and it was just a fantastic experience to see the kids' faces when they came into our room, and they all got the official Philadelphia Flyer pucks from the ice, and they got to come into our room and just hang out with us and ask us questions and have pictures taken, and it was a lot of fun for them, and it's a lot of fun for us.
And even beyond that, and I'm pretty sure the website probably explains that as well, but you and I think Lyle Sides, Brad Watson, the local guys, I mean, you're involved in, you've been involved with the Cassie Campbell Street Hockey Festival, I mean, numerous golf tournaments and stuff. You guys also on your own are back into the community in off seasons as well, right?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of the organizers find out, you know, that we're from Calgary, and then they'll approach us and say, "Would you be interested in being a celebrity?" And we're like, "Well, we're not celebrities, but you know, we'll come and smack a ball into the trees and tell some stories and just enjoy the day with whoever you want to put us with." And it's a really neat way to get back to the community and meet just your regular hockey fan, or, you know, some of them aren't hockey fans, and
sure,
by the end of the day, they're like, "Oh, you know, I got to come to a game and just see what goes on here."
Having said that, one of the things that you can find out at the NHLOfficials.com is, you know, a little bio on everybody. So we were looking at your bio. 1,635 regular season games. There are only six NHL players who have played more games than that. Do you know who they are?
Geez, I'd have to say Jágr would be one.
Nope.
Well, then I haven't got a clue.
Dave Andrechuk, Chris Chelios, Mark Recchi, Ron Francis, Mark Messier, and Gordie Howe are the only players who have played more games or been in NHL, more NHL regular season games than you have.
Oh, I wouldn't have even been close on any of them.
Is that...
None of them are still playing, and yet here's Mike still...
Well, yeah, there is that. And you're going to catch Andrechuk and Chelios likely this year, close to it, I think. For those who don't know, how many games do you work a year in the regular season?
We're contracted over the course of a season to do 74 games. For linesmen, referees are 72.
Okay. Now, will you ever go beyond that? Or
Depending on certain travel situations, weather, and injuries, we've had guys go over. I think this year we had four or five guys go over whatever our prorated amount of games were because of the shortened season.
Now, what about in terms of frequency? Because in the NHL, we know scheduling, you can't play three games in a row like they do in the American Hockey League. What about your scheduling?
Ours is we can do four games in four nights.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, that's the max.
Is that common?
It is in certain areas. Like when you're working in California, you can do four and four nights between San Jose, LA, and Anaheim.
Right.
When you're east, going up and down the coast, Rangers, Islanders, Jersey, Philadelphia.
Okay.
Up through there. You might do it in Florida when they're both having a home stand, you go back and forth between the two cities. Maybe Nashville, Pittsburgh, and Columbus, you might get it in there as well with St. Louis.
Sure. How many times, you know, how much does that happen for you, Mike? I mean, how many, because you're out west, do you do a lot? I mean, once or twice in a season?
For me, I would probably venture four or five times. I would do four and four.
Oh, okay, okay. So yeah. What's a common workload then? Is it two and two? Or?
It's usually two, day off, two, or you do three, day off, one, day off, two.
Okay, okay. So in terms of rest, because you were talking about it before, I mean, how much... typical week for you, how much time do you spend at home?
Out of a month, I'm probably gone 20 to 21 days, okay. 20 or 22 days out of a month. And then when you come home, you know, you might throw in a game here at home in Calgary or one in Edmonton, and then you're back on the road again. So
okay, can I keep going down this path?
Well, and I just wanted to quickly at one, like when you talk about 20 to 22 days, and you both being family men, you are on the road. So what about for you? Like, what is the...
Well, because we do on television, we'll do more than half on the road, but close to half at home. Mm-hmm. So I'm at home preparing, which is a luxury that you very rarely have, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, even my... You know, when I'm home and I have a game, it's kind of like you're on the road because you know, you have your routine where you get up in the morning. I'll take my daughter to the bus station or to the bus stop, off to the gym, home, have lunch, try to nap, and then get to the rink here if it's a 7 o'clock game, you know, somewhere between 5:15 and 5:45, and just get mentally ready to step on the ice and do what I need to do.
Yeah, I guess the only difference for us would be, you know, we're usually here in the morning for morning skate, right? Mm-hmm. But other than that, you know, it isn't the same. It's not the same as being at home in the summertime for sure. Right?
Oh no,
who takes care of you guys? I mean, you have skate issues. You were just talking about injuries and things like that. Do you really rely on the home teams?
The home team guys are really really good. If we ever have an issue, what we'll try to do is get to them as early as we can. If we know we have an equipment issue, you know, we'll try to call them in the morning and let them know, "Hey, do you have this available? Can you fix this? Can I drop it off? You know, I'm 10 minutes from your rink. Can I bring it in, leave it with you, and have it ready for game time?" That's the ultimate scenario. That's the one they prefer, rather than show up at 10 to 6 for a 7 o'clock game and then, "Can you fix my skate blade?" It's right. You know, because they've got their players that they need to deal with and things they need to do before the game. So the sooner we can get to them, when it comes to injuries, usually if it's something that we needed to get taken care of right away. They'll tell us to come in after the morning skate, and they'll have either their physio guy or whatever to work on us. And then they may say, you know, you might need another treatment before you step on the ice. So can you be here at 4:30? And, you know, they'll throw you in with the injured guys and just work on you and, you know, hopefully get you so that you can get on the ice and do your job.
Mike Sigwick, our guest, I'm going to ask questions that nobody's ever thought to ask before. How many pairs of skates do you go through in a year?
One.
Really?
Wow. Yep.
See, I would have had it. Now, how many do you carry with you when you go?
One.
So when you're traveling, do you here's the other one. Do you take it on the plane with you?
No, we were having issues with that.
Post-9/11?
Post-9/11. Now, apparently, TSA will allow you to take your skates on as long as the covers are on your blades.
Have you ever lost your luggage?
Oh, many times.
Yeah.
It seems to be the preferred destination is Minnesota.
Anybody who travels knows that one. That's not uncommon.
My bags, my equipment bag has been to Hawaii, it's been to Florida, and it was on its way to Tahiti out of Minnesota one time, and it was just kind of, I was like, well, how did it get there?
So you, it's safe to say you've had to borrow equipment.
No, because the teams don't carry skates to fit me, so I just kind of, the game in Minnesota, I sat there and watched in the corner with our security rep. Well, they worked with three guys, which is one of the reasons why they went to the four-man system, is because if we were still doing the three-man system and I couldn't get on the ice, then they'd be doing the game with two guys. So that was one of the kind of things that they brought in when they brought in the four-man system.
You are known as a large guy. How big are the feet?
16.
Wow. Jeez.
Wow, yeah, so I guess you're right. Not a lot of teams are in Boston, maybe?
No, you know what? Surprisingly, sure. I asked Zdeno Chara one night on the ice, and he only wears size 12.
Oh, wow.
That's not going to work, then.
That's what I said. I go, well, I guess I can't use you.
That's awesome.
Mike Civics with us, NHL linesman here in the Hot Stove Lounge, joining us for the full hour. Plenty of things to get into. And we had you in here during the lockout, and you came in. We only had you for a segment, but the boss was like, make sure you ask him how many miles or kilometers he logs in a year. And we'll throw out the 48-game season, so let's look ahead to an 82-game year next year. If you were to throw down kilometers logged by Mike Civic on his travels around the NHL, what would it end up being?
About 110,000.
110,000.
And I might be off on this, but a team like Calgary or a Western-based team would be in that 45,000 to 50,000 range.
I would think so. Yeah.
So why is it such a high travel log for you? How come so many miles get logged by officials?
Well, it just seems that when the person that does our scheduling does the schedule, my preferred destination is east. My home rink apparently last year was New Jersey, where I worked 5 games. I only worked 3 in Calgary. Mm. So, you know, that's a 6-hour flight to Jersey and five plus going there and 6 coming home. So, for whatever reason, they like to work me Midwest to the East.
How does the scheduling work out? How do they make sure that, you know, you don't end up being in one rink any more than the other, and that one team doesn't see a group of officials any more than another, or that you don't work with the same guys too much? It has to be a complicated process.
Well, the guy that does our scheduling has a frequency table and stuff like this, more so for the referees than the linesmen, but he does kind of watch where the linesmen are going as well. So I don't know the numbers because they don't tell us, but we do know that they have a frequency chart that they monitor where guys are working and how many times. So he's in charge of that. And whenever the schedule comes out, you book your flights, you book your hotels, and you get a hold of the other guys and find out if there's car rentals or whatever.
You do that all yourself? You do all the booking yourself?
Do that all ourselves.
Holy cow. So are you super elite?
I was going to be this year. I will get it by the end of this season, or by the end of this year, I will have it.
The only people I've ever known.
I lost my, you know, lost my super elite. That was hurtful.
I lost the hotel ones are big for us, right?
Right.
Because if you get, because
you'd
the,
never be able to log super. You don't travel enough.
No, but what it affects us is if we get to the gold level, then usually things like the internet is paid for and stuff like that. And I know people are saying, well, that's silly, but little things like that make the difference.
Well, I mean, when you check into a hotel and they want $12.95 to log onto the internet, you know, you're in a hotel for 40 nights. That becomes expensive.
Well, absolutely. Crews, how much do you work with the same guys? How or does that even you know, come into play?
There again, it depends on the area that you're in. If you're in California, if you're working seven games, you'll probably work with the same linesman three or four games
right.
together, and then they'll bring in another guy. And depending on where you are and they are and they're going, it could change every other game.
Do you ever forget who you're working with? Do you ever?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Right? Because it's got to be a blur at some point.
Well,
right?
you travel so much, and let's say you're doing four and four nights and you're in your fourth city, and you go into your afternoon nap and you get up and you're drooling all over yourself and your alarm clock goes off and you go like, oh damn, I missed the game. And then as your heart's coming back to normal, you're like, okay, who am I here with? So yeah. Then you got to either open up your book. I write it in a book, so I'm when it comes to electronics, they don't like me. So I write it in a book. I go, oh yeah, okay, I'm working with this guy. Phew, I'm good. He's got the car.
Okay, so you forget who you're working with sometimes. Does it ever kind of just become you're walking into an arena? Does it matter where? Like, I'm walking into another arena. Does that ever be, where am I? Am I going to is this, am I in this building or am I not? Does it ever kind of get old hat in that regard?
Well, no, when you walk into the building, you know which one you're walking into, but it's like, when you walk in here, it's okay, walk past security, turn left. In Pittsburgh, walk down, hop in the elevator, down the elevator, turn right, turn left, you're there.
Do they feed you? Or are you responsible for meals?
Most of the rinks now are giving us something to eat after the games,
okay.
Which we never had before. Here again, it's kind of morphed into something that, you know, it started in one rink and then another rink heard and then another rink heard. And then, we get some team people come down now, you know, what would you guys like for, you know, to eat after the game? They give us some choices now, and it's actually really nice because now you don't have to rush out of the rink and find a place that you might have to order before 11 o'clock before they close the grill where you can get, maybe a soup or a salad
Phoenix,
or something.
You mean? That place is terrible.
It's got
a whole nightclub district, and you can't get food after 9.
Yeah, well, in some places it's funny, but it's always nice after a game to have something healthy sure. rather than, here's your choice: fried chicken wings, fried calamari, fried zucchini, or French fries.
Yeah.
Is there one arena that's or a few arenas that stand out to you in terms of best accommodations in the officials' room or anything like that?
Columbus is really, really good. The room is average, but how they treat us at the end of the game with the food they bring in. Edmonton's been really good. They've switched up the room there for us, and their food selection is really good. Anaheim's really good. Most of them are pretty good. Those are the ones that come to mind that are the best.
So what goes on behind what's in the officials room? What do you guys have back there?
If you were to walk in, you'd see four chairs, four big equipment bags, equipment all over the place. There's a table with usually the lineups, the misconduct sheets. It'll tell us stick violations and all those kind of things. Yeah. Who's on the bubble if you've had, two game misconducts, one you're suspended and all that kind of stuff. There'd be a phone in case Toronto needs to call us. Then just your usual shower and amenities there.
I just wanted to piggyback off that. I'm curious about how you guys have been affected with these buildings turning into multi-purposes. I mean, you've seen it here in Calgary. They had to tear out some of the dressing rooms to fit in the Jumbotron guys, and the visiting teams lost the coach's room and things like that. You guys have probably been stuck in some closets, I'm guessing.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean,
they're not building new buildings with you guys in mind.
No, they're not. And, that's just, here again, we're part of the game, but when it comes to thinking about us, it's like, oh, yeah, we got to put them somewhere, eh? let's see the plans. Where's the room? Yeah, well, that might fit. We can get a toilet and a shower in there, so here you go. Edmonton was really good. Kevin Lowe came to us a few times and asked us, what things would you guys like in a referee's room when we're building this new arena.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're starting to think more and more about not so much our comfort, but just a place where we can go and we have room to do what we need to do and not worry about anything else.
In the corner. Lots of good stuff to get into with Mike Civic, and there's so many stories and a lot of things that we kind of want to get into when it comes to the state of officiating and things like that. So let's go there first, because I know that you were talking about a little bit earlier.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of... I'm a fan of what you guys do, because I think, you know, you don't have a voice out there. You don't have anybody that stands up for you. You take, as a group of officials, every playoffs, it seems like it's the same thing. All of a sudden, you guys have gotten exponentially dumber.
Yep.
And you've gotten these top secret phone calls from Gary, who doesn't want this team to win and all of that. I mean, it's to me, it's a different life. Like, it's a different, you guys have thick skin, and I'm just marvel at what you guys do. I mean, it's so under the radar and underappreciated. At least that's how I feel about it.
Yeah, you know, it's all my buddies, you know, I'll get texts from her. They'll call me, or, you know, when I'm at my buddy's pub while my daughter's dancing, I'll get the people come over and say, you know, what memo came out that Boston's supposed to win or Philly's supposed to lose, or, you know, whatever happened that the night before, or something that happened before I even get there. And it's like, you know, we don't, the league has nothing to gain by telling us to have one team win or lose. We're there, you know, Terry Gregson tells us every year at training camp, we're the keepers of the game. We got to make sure that it's played fair and safe. Everything else is out of our hands. So, you know, if the conspiracy theorists out there have these things that they want to go on, then, you know what, jump on Mr. Branson's airplane and head to the moon and continue your conspiracy theories up there, because they hold no water down here.
Hallelujah, brother. Let's get him on that plane.
Are you desensitized to that at this point? Like, are you like a player, you block it all out and it doesn't bother you anymore?
It doesn't bother me. I just kind of chuckle about it. And then sometimes, depending on my mood, I'll just run with it for a while. And
fair enough.
Mike, I want to get into a couple of things, but let's because we're talking about 1,600 games, and your first game was late 80s, right? I believe 87 and around there?
Yep, 1987.
Actually, my favorite part, always an opportunity for us to play Brass Bonanza, but your first playoff game was a Hartford Whalers playoff game, which I love against
the Bruins. Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
But having said that, you can make a case that you've gone through the run-and-gun Oiler 80s, as they call them, into the Jacques Lemaire trap part of, you know, the last decade, into the post original first lockout, whatever we want to call on the, you know, that on the ice. How has the game changed in your tenure?
Well, when I first started, you know, you had the you didn't have the clutching and grabbing, you know, of the Gretzky era. And I mean, you know, with the team they had up there, you know, if 7 goals got behind Grant, they knew they were going to win the game because they were going to score 8,
right?
Then it morphed into, when the Devils won the Stanley Cup, it was all this trapping and interference and holding up and all these other things that creeped into our game. And then they had to find a way to get that out of the game. So then they brought in all these new terminologies of obstruction. And I can't even remember all of them anymore. There were so many of them. But now we've kind of gone past that era into where we are now, where the game is, it's a fast game. And I think that's why we're having the horrific collisions that we're having, whether it's in the neutral zone or even on icings now. And everybody's up in arms about, you know, touch icing. And I was in the game in Carolina when Yanni Pinkinen hurt himself. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not sure if he did his ankle or whatever, but that had nothing to do with the guy chasing him on the icing. It was Yanni went to stop, hit a rut in the ice, and that's what caused his feet to come out.
Yeah.
And, you know, should it be in, shouldn't it be in? It's for people in bigger offices than for me to say. I always liked the race for the puck. You know, ever since I played and through 26 years, that's how I've always done it. So maybe call me a dinosaur, but being on the lines and having to get down there to make that call, that's part of my job, and I like doing that.
But the players, have they changed? Because it's one of those crutches we use in the media. They're bigger, they're faster, they're stronger than they've ever been. Well, you've been on the ice for a couple of these things. Like, I mean, are the players different now than they were then?
Oh, yeah, they're way bigger, stronger, and faster.
They are, eh?
Oh,
absolutely. So that's not a myth. That's fact.
No, that is 100% fact. They are when I first started, your fourth line guy was lucky to get up and down the ice. Now your fourth line guy is a very pivotal person in your lineup. He's got to be able to get up and down the ice and score a goal.
Mm-hmm.
Do you and that'll morph into the conversation about the lockout in just a second. But do you ever find yourself kind of getting caught up while you're watching games? Do you ever find in the drama of it, or do you have to be so focused so that doesn't happen.
When you're first into the business as an official, I think you do get caught up. And there's a story here that my first game in L.A. when Gretzky was there, I'm the back linesman. And Gretzky's coming around the corner. The puck is shot high and hard off the glass. He's got a stick in the air, and I see it just hit his stick. Now it drops, and I think, okay, well, the defenseman's going to get it. Well, the defenseman fumbles the puck. He misses it, actually. Gretzky goes, grabs it, goes down the ice, and scores. Now, of course, it shouldn't have been a goal because Gretzky hit it with a high stick. And I was like, I ended up being a observer instead of a worker. And Gretzky knew I saw it, too, because he skated by him, and he looked at me, and he said, what's going on? And I was like, I didn't answer. Because I knew, oh, boy, I missed that one. Back then, we didn't have 19 cameras watching us, though, so I don't know if it ever got back to Toronto or not. But about a week later, I had the same situation with L.A. in a different game, and I called it, and he came by and he gave me a wink.
That's awesome. Mike Civic is with us of an NHL linesman, more than 1,600 games as an NHL official. And you know, talking about how the game changed, well, we didn't play hockey in October, November, December, and half of January. And so the season starts in 2013, midway through. And for you, it had to be an adjustment. I mean, you didn't skate like you usually do for a long time and far longer than you're used to. What was the adjustment like for you and your brethren?
Well, it was interesting because we had our training camp prior to the lockout starting. So we'd already had our training camp and done our medicals and our physicals and everything that we needed to do to get ready. For us, it was just a waiting game to, hopefully maintain some semblance of conditioning and weight, that you went to at training camp, and try to get on the ice as much as you can, doing whatever you can. None of our guys worked in the American League or the Western League or any of those leagues. We never took anybody's position in any other league. So we just kind of sat there, waited for the day that they announced that the games were going on, and then get ready for whenever the assignments came out to step on the ice and get going. The first probably four or five games would be our adjustment period of what we would normally go through in the exhibition season.
Right.
But the games actually meant something. So you had to be that much more focused to make sure that you were doing what you needed to do.
So that's pretty quick, four or five games, because we were talking, 10 and 20 games in some cases for players. Could you see a noticeable difference in the pace and the execution on the ice after all that time off?
You could tell some of the players that had played somewhere and versus the ones that didn't, because the ones that played, they at least had some ability to get up and down the ice and do their job like they were supposed to. The guys that didn't play, their shifts were shorter. Passes were off the mark. It was scrambly, and that was an adjustment for us, because normally by that time we know pretty much what a player is going to do and not going to do. And when they got on the ice, they didn't know what they were doing, and it kind of, you're going like, well, what am I doing? Which way do I go? And right. Oh, you got hit with the puck again. Normally that's not a play you would make. So why did you do that?
Wow. So and how long did it take? Like, was it noticeable game by game that it was getting better, or was it more gradual?
Where I was, in my travels, it was, I think it was noticeable from game to game. It seemed every game got a little crisper, a little faster, a little more pace to it, a little more like you were in a hockey game versus my Saturday morning shinny where it's haphazard.
So it wasn't quite that bad. Mike Civic is with us, NHL linesman, more than 1,600 games.
The general managers met today prior to Game 4 of the Stanley Cup Final, and look like we're going to move ahead with some more adjustments in the game. We were talking about icing a moment ago, but how does that practically impact you guys? I mean, if there's going to be some adjustments, we think hybrid icing is going to be brought in and tested. How will that affect you? Will you guys get stuff to read in the summer, video to watch in the summer, or does that all come in your training camp?
No, we'll get that all at training camp, and probably what we'll do is when the referees break off to talk about whatever new things they want the referees to do, the linesmen will break off into our group, and we'll go through the policy of how they want it to be done, the procedure of how they want it to be done. Then we'll probably go on the ice, and we'll have some situations where we'll practice it, and then, we'll step off the ice, go back into a group, and discuss what's different scenarios that, from our perspective, could come about with this hybrid icing thing, and then put it in a, you know, if we find some glaring errors or things that we think are going to be issues with it, then we'll put it in writing, send it to Terry, and then Terry, from my understanding, will send it back to the competition committee, and they'll look at it, and then they'll make a decision, and we'll get direction from there.
It's one of the things I've never understood is why you, as officials, don't necessarily have a voice at the competition committee, or do you? I mean, does your stuff go back through the league and the league represents your concerns?
My understanding is certain meetings will have maybe one or two representatives, but they don't vote and they just sit there. They take notes, and if they're asked to produce an opinion, then they go ahead and do that. But other than that, it's through the NHL pipeline.
We talked about the timeline here. You've seen a lot of things come in, and I mean, I can't imagine, it must have been about a 30-page rule book when you started, and it's now close to 200. How long does it take you to get something to become intuitive?
Oh, early on in my career, it was easy because we didn't have, you know, as Bob Myers would always say, you only call what you knew, and that way you didn't get in trouble. So
yeah.
Now you got to know a lot. So it just, you know, the new things that they bring out, you know, if it's every season or every two or three seasons, you just highlight those. And when you're on a plane or you're delayed somewhere, you pull out your book and you read it and you try to get it ingrained in your mind. And then hopefully when you get on the ice and you see that situation, you just react to it without thinking about it.
Right. Your relationship, you're at the top of your game. What's your personal relationship with those coming up? Do you act as a mentor? Have you been a mentor in the past?
Yeah. Years ago, when I was getting into the, you know, second and third rounds of the playoffs, I was working with junior guys, and, I don't know if this is a credit to me or just dumb luck, but each one of the guys that I worked with and mentored through the season and in through those playoffs have all worked finals. Mm. So, you know, I like to think that maybe I had something to offer that got them, you know, to the next level. But it just, you know, at my point in my career now, I think I'm more mentoring and not so much on the ice, because the guys coming up now are pretty knowledgeable in the game of hockey as to what they need to do on the ice. It's more off the ice, and with all the distractions of the internet and games and all this other stuff, it's they still have to remember that, you know, you got to get up and eat breakfast in the morning, and then there's a physical component to our job, so you got to get in the gym and do something, whether it's a half-hour bike ride or a half-hour run, or just do something, get out of your room, clear your mind of all the junk that's out there, and then get ready, have a nice lunch. You know, we'll talk about whatever we talk about at lunch, depending on the two teams that are playing, and then go back. And if it's, you know, you have a nap or you go for a walk in the afternoon or whatever, just get yourself mentally ready to hit the ice at 7:10 and ready to go.
Mike, is it still, and this has always been my opinion, so I'll ask you, is it still the number one problem in officiating recruitment and retention?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not having any boys, I don't get the luxury of listening to all the crazy hockey parents, but I hear all the stories from our other guys that have boys playing hockey. And it just, you know, it just boggles my mind that as soon as parents walk into a hockey rink, that they leave their mind in their car or someplace, that they just act the way they do when their kids are playing. They got to remember, when I played hockey, we played for fun. Nobody was going anywhere.
Yeah.
We played hockey for fun. Our coach taught us life skills, how to get along with people, how to work as a team, all, you know, all those things that are very important when you start entering school, and then you go to university, and then you get into the workforce. You've got to have these life skills. And they sit in the stands and they berate other kids, they berate other parents, they berate the officials, and they forget that the kid that's out there officiating is probably almost the same age or a little bit older than their son who's playing. And they berate them for an hour and 15 minutes, and then they wonder why they can't keep young kids in the program. And yeah. I don't know what the solution is.
One of the things that I'm thinking about, and I guess I'm the benefit of all of our listeners, I'm throwing it by you to see what you think. I've listened to all this complaining every year at the same time about officiating, but nobody ever seems to come up with a solution. And Mike, I think one of the things that I think we can affect is recruitment. I would like to see a program started where we visit high-end players who've gotten something out of this game, junior A players, major junior players, college players, who, you know, have gotten an education, gotten whatever, and put upon them to give something back to the game. Put a year of service into coaching or to officiating, and then make it easy for them. Make it, here's how you do it. Here's how you get involved. I would really, I think there could be some success there, because it's one thing to get people involved, but I look at a guy like Kyle Raymond, right? Junior A player, loved the game, got back. It was only 10 years later he's in the National Hockey League as an official.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a guy working right now the Stanley Cup Finals, Wes McCauley.
Right.
He was a you know, just an average hockey player at college, got his degree. His dad was our boss at one point in time before he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
So he's grown up around hockey, but he wanted to be a hockey player. He tried that. He knew he wasn't going anywhere. He's seen his dad work with the officials and just thought, you know what, I'm going to give this a try. And, you know, Wes is a great referee. He's a great kid. I remember him walking in the dressing room of Maple Leaf Gardens when he was 7 years old.
Yep. And here,
you know,
he is.
You know, he's a great role model in his community. He's a great referee. I mean, before him, we had Paul Stewart.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Stewie would get beat up in a game, and next you know, he's refereeing one.
I look at the high-end guys, because I think that there's real benefits that come from playing the game. I was never anything more than a local. I never played on high-end teams. I was a grassroots player, a house league player. But I got so much out of the game that I feel I have a responsibility to give back. And I just think that we – and it's not that these kids are – I just think they don't know. I just think if we could get in and teach them and go, look, you got 2 or 3 years left, but here's how you can get involved in officiating. Give us a year back. Even like the Northern Exposure thing, where the guy went and became the doctor in Alaska because Alaska paid for his education.
Yep.
Well, maybe we'll give you a scholarship, but then you got to give us 5 years of officiating and things like that. I just like to see something.
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. And you know, the good part about that is, you know, some of those guys that have played a high level of hockey have got what, you know, I guess the new hockey term is they've got great hockey sense, so they understand the game.
Yeah.
So the only thing you really have to teach them is when you get on the ice is how to interpret the rule book in accordance to how the game is being played.
Mike Civic, more than 1,600 games officiated, and the final part of this interview will just be some fun storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to that. But I just want to read one email to you from a friend of mine who is an official. I won't use his name, but he's an official here in Calgary with the Central Zone, and he says, I'd be really interested if Mike has an opinion about the recent ruling to take body checking out of Pee Wee hockey. And before we get into the storytelling, knowing it's been a hot button topic in this city for the last year or so.
Year plus, yeah.
I think a lot of people would be interested to hear your take on it.
Well, yeah, I have an opinion. When I played, our biggest thrill was, here we go, I'm going to go way back. We were skating on outdoor ice that we had to shovel before we played, and our biggest thrill was body checking somebody over the boards into the snowbank. So my take on this, because like I told you two, I don't have a son playing hockey, but I hear the stories. And, you know, I watch some of these guys in their practices and stuff like this. I think it's a bit of an overreaction to some things that are going on in the game. And I think part of the issue or part of the problem is they spend all this time teaching guys how to skate, how to stick handle, how to go around cones and stuff like this. They don't take the time to teach players, especially at that age, how to protect themselves and actually how to do a body check. When I played, a body check was it was a skill that was used to move the person off of the puck so that you could get the puck. You watch some of our games now, it's a body check is thrown to annihilate the person into the boards to get the puck. And that is not how or the reason for a body check. And I think if and I don't know the hierarchy of how this has to go through, but I think if they took the time to teach these kids, number one, how to protect themselves, when to do and give a body check, when not to, this wouldn't be an issue. But they spend so much time with all these other skills and stuff like this that gets forgotten, and the kids don't know how to protect themselves. The kids don't know the warning signs for them not to deliver a body check, so they go ahead and do it because they don't know any better.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just my take is that I think if they spent more time teaching the kids how to deliver and how to receive a body check, we wouldn't even be talking about this.
Separate the player from the puck, not separate the head from the shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we in the media played a large role in that by glorifying big hits, and now it's come home to roost. I mean, we've created these video series of guys getting concussions, and now we've got, to me, we've got a safety issue, and I Mike, I'm of a like mind. I think a lot of this is coaching, but at the same time, how are we supporting our coaches, right? How are we giving them the tools and things like that? And sometimes the avenue of least resistance, which is just to say, okay, let's take this right out of the equation, is where we end up.
Yeah.
My only hope in all of this, one last political thing, is that, okay, you've taken it out. Make sure you study the heck out of this. Make sure that you study the ramifications and see how this plays itself mm-hmm. out. Because we may, at the end of the day, find out that this wasn't the right thing.
Yeah, well, right? And, you know, over and above that is, you take it out at that level, what are you teaching the next level when they are allowed to go body check?
Right. It comes back to that. It's the skill. And it is a skill,
yep.
which I think we, somewhere along the line, sometimes forget.
1,600-plus games means some stories. So we got 5 minutes or so less. It's still some rapid fire and trying to get some gold from Mike.
Well, here, I got to go even before we start. When I was working in the Western Hockey League, I was working a game in Medicine
yes.
Hat, and Moose Jaw was playing, and there was a certain player for the Moose Jaw Warriors who was about 5'6". I think they list him at 5'7" when he played. We have a little skirmish going on in the Moose Jaw crease. I'm skating in because I'm the back linesman. This guy comes in behind me and takes me out, and I go flying into the net. Can you name the player?
I think I know exactly. I think he might be listening right now.
Oh, Theo listens all the time.
He might be listening right now.
Needless to say, I wasn't very happy. I grabbed him. I think I manhandled him, and as I was taking him to the bench, I'm not sure if I had him off the ice or I was just dragging him with me, but Graham wasn't very happy with me.
who's historically or even recently, who's the funniest guy out there? Who's the guy that cracks you up?
Oh, geez. It was he played in Colorado. His name escapes me right now.
Ian LaPerriere.
He would come up with some of the funniest stuff. Like things could be happening all over the place, and it's just mayhem. And he would skate by once you've got it all, and both coaches are yelling, players are yelling, and he'd skate by, and he'd come out with something, and you just sit there and you start to giggle, and you go like, I can't be laughing here because this is everybody's mad, and all I need to do is be seen laughing on camera, and what's he laughing at?
Anybody stick out in your mind that gave you the most grief or the most pushback?
Ooh, at what day?
I take it there's a lot of them. There's not one guy that sticks out.
No, it all depends on if the team's playing poorly, he's not getting ice time. He's a scorer and he's not scoring, and the coach is all over him. The media is all over him. He comes out and let's say he's a centerman. You drop the puck, he loses the face off because he thinks the other guy's cheating. So he'll start screaming at you, and you're screaming at him back, going like, maybe if you scored a goal, you wouldn't be here. And then you go like, oh, why'd I say that?
Mike, does a young guy kind of have to pay his dues with you, are you, one of those guys that appreciates veterans, I guess?
Yeah, I'm kind of old school. There was a situation in Edmonton in a certain individual's first exhibition game. He hadn't even played a regular season game. It's his first exhibition game. And first offside, he proceeded to tell me that I wasn't very good at my job. And I looked up at the clock. I'm going like, wow, you've had a whole 40 seconds here. So I threw him out of the face-off just because. And then a couple of shifts later, he comes out, same thing, offside. He looks at me, goes, you're brutal. And I looked at Kelly Buckberger from across the ice. I yelled at Kelly. I said, Kelly, you better talk to this guy because he ain't going to last very long. Kelly goes, I'm all over it, Mike.
Have you had any problems with this unnamed player since?
Me personally, no.
Somebody asked on the text line, any story trying to break up a fight that sticks out to you?
Oh, yeah, when I had my nose broken. I was breaking up. I thought I was Superman one night, and Sean Cronin jumped Ron Stern, and I went to
Cronin the Barbarian.
Yeah, I went to pull Cronin, and I had my arm across Sterny, so he couldn't do anything. I forget that he throws lefts, so I'm holding him by his chest, and next thing you know, here comes a left. Mrs. Sterney hits me right in the nose. I look down as I'm trying to break it up. Finally, my partner gets over, and there's blood all over the ice. I'm going like, who's bleeding? Here comes Bearcat. He throws a towel on my nose and says, come on, kid, let's get out of here. Your nose is broken.
That's awesome.
Tell me about coaches, because we, in television, we're always showing that shot of a coach berating you guys. I mean, are there any, good relationship stories there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Bob Johnson was such a nice man behind the bench. I don't think you can get him to yell at us if he tried. Elaine Vigneault is pretty funny behind the bench. I mean, he'll rant and rave, and then you know, you'll skate by, and then Rick Bonus will say something goofy, and he'll start laughing, and you'll turn around and go, what are you laughing at? You're used to yelling at me. Pat Quinn was always good for some great one-liners.
Right, yeah.
My first game that I had with St. Louis, I'm pretty sure it was with Boston, and I'm going to forget his name just because I'm trying to think of it. But he was a coach for Boston there for a while. And that was when we had our name bars on our jerseys. So I'm standing in front of the bench, and he's looking down at me. He goes, CVIK. What's that, a radio station?